Ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great pleasure to welcome you here this evening to the opening of the Eric Mottram Archive. As many of you will know, Eric Mottram was a many-faceted man, a scholar, a poet, one of the first proponents in the United Kingdom of American Studies. Not least, he was also a lecturer, then a professor in the Department of English at King's College, London. On his sudden and very untimely death, his family inherited an unrivalled collection of manuscripts, books, recordings, other artefacts, which have been some trouble for the archivist to decide how to describe occasionally. They have all come as a gift to King's College to form the Eric Mottram Collection, of which the archive is a major part. I'm particularly pleased to have the opportunity to thank Brenda McIntosh and Brian Mottram, Eric's brother and sister, for their generosity to the college and also for being with us tonight. The college intends that the Eric Mottram Archive will not only be a tribute to a great and a much missed scholar and colleague, but it'll also make Eric's works and his interests available to other researchers and students. You will have seen, or you will have an opportunity to see this evening, a small sample of the contents of the archive and be able to see from the computer-based catalogue what else is available. It's over there that you can look at in the interval. In using that catalogue and looking at the sample of the materials, you'll actually be seeing some of the work, the results of the work of the archivist for the project, Bill Griffiths, who himself was an old friend of Eric's. I hope that before you leave, you will certainly make time to make a first survey of the material being opened to the public for the first time. It's always been our plan that Eric should be commemorated by lectures in his name to be given by distinguished scholars. It's a great honour that the first such lecture is to be given by Professor Stanley Cavell of the University of Harvard, one of the most eminent scholars working today, and it says in my notes either side, I think perhaps both sides, is with your frequency of travel, is a better description. And his work crosses the boundaries of philosophy, literature and cultural studies. I won't try to rehearse it, I won't take some of his time. There's a very nice and apt description and also a good bibliography of some of your works in the programme. It's my great pleasure now, Professor Cavell, to ask you to give us the first of the lectures in commemoration of Eric Mottram, Identifying Praise in Moments of Henry James and Fred Astaire.
Evening. The establishment of an archive of the kind we've just heard described is a remarkable undertaking, and I'm very pleased that the organizers of the present occasion have found it, the work that I do, appropriate to represent an appropriate tone to include in its celebration. Also, it's wonderful to be in London. The moments in Henry James and in Fred Astaire that I shall ask you to consider. How's the sound? Right. Each of the moments autobiographically grounded in the works of two recognized American masters of their respective arts are each cases in which a life is depicted whose crisis is expressed as an inability to find the means or the conditions of praise. Quite as if some difficulty in the act of expressing praise, some barrier to the acknowledgement of gratitude, has raised a question as to the expressive powers of language as such, speech as such, as if our recurrent doubts of language's capacity to represent the world is linked to a steady sense of its insufficiency in providing the unfolding of desire, as if to be human is, to some irreducible extent, to suffer aphasia. Even someone who might recognize in these dark remarks echoes of preoccupations of mine with issues of skepticism, often with interpretations of Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations in its responses to the threat of inexpressiveness and the twin threat of exposure, allegorized, for example, in Wittgenstein's Fantasy of a Private Language, and more recently touched in adducing Lacan's picture of full and empty speech. Even such a one will be surprised, as I have been myself, by the intrusion into these matters of the phenomenon of praise in fairly obviously secular or secularized contexts. Praise in non-secular context, as for example the Psalms, is not surprising. The moment in James is represented in a late story. Most of the people that I've spoken about this hadn't read it. I hadn't read it until a year or so ago. Don't know why. Story called The Birthplace. It's about the keeper of a museum or shrine established to preserve and celebrate the memory of an author never named, but unmistakably implied to be Shakespeare. The drama of the story, focused on the keeper of the shrine, is to discover whether in his official guiding of the pilgrims who visit it, there's a route of praise along which to remain true to his own knowledge of the poverty of what is really known about the author's birth and existence, and at the same time to encourage the pilgrims to the shrine to believe, as the owners of the institution demand of him, and as the pilgrims crave of him, that the place is, to believe that the place is indubitably the scene and actually bears the marks of the author's birth, the location touched by the original signs, the first sensory orientations of his genius. The moment in a stair is divided into two successive routines from perhaps the last of the great Hollywood musicals, The Bandwagon, from 1953, one of the most critically admired of the Astaire musicals. The first of the routines is about as uneventful as anything amounting to a routine can be. It lasts 90 seconds and consists of a man walking alone down a train platform, meditatively singing a not obviously demanding song. The second routine is four times as long, rife with events, even garish. I'll eventually argue that the routines are linked as something like question and answer. When I chose to include the first of the routines as a set piece in an address this past Christmas to the American Philosophical Association, I thought I was pretty well in control of the philosophical and critical causes of my fascination with it. That was a year ago, Christmas. I wanted its air of the uneventful to stand as an emblem of the ordinary, a conjunction of ideas that I've called attention to elsewhere. And I wanted the emphasis on walking to stand for moments I have isolated in Ralph Waldo Emerson's association of walking with thinking, and in Wittgenstein's putting following a rule on the level of walking as a part of our human natural history, and in Kierkegaard's seeking the sublime in the pedestrian. Instances that I have invoked in making out the concepts of the ordinary and of skepticism as one another's creation and nemesis. Wittgenstein remarks in Philosophical Investigations, "What we do is to bring words back from their metaphysical to their everyday use." The force of this description of his procedures is retained if we substitute skepticism for metaphysics and say, bring words back from their skeptical to their everyday use, since what Wittgenstein means by metaphysics, the subliming of our concepts, he calls it, and what I understand skepticism to be, are positive and negative poles of philosophy's chronic flight from, sometimes I've called it philosophy's disappointment in, the ordinary. Just how the concept or phenomenon of praise presents itself in response to this disappointment is an essential point of connection between an impasse in the James story and an aporia with which we are left in or by the Astaire routine. In both, a necessity of praise on pain of losing authority over one's experience is intertwined with a doubt as to the possibility of effective or acceptable praise. In the James, the barrier to praise lies in our knowing too little about something. In the Astaire, in our knowing too much. I knew from the beginning of my choice of the Astaire case that it might prove to be less innocent than I had made out in my talk to the philosophers. But since the issue of praise was not then focused on what I read as a scene of Astaire's praise of black dancing, the second routine, but was intended as continued, as confined to my right to praise Astaire's art, who is, after all, one of the incontestably great American dancers of the 20th century, I felt safe enough to proceed in innocence. Recently, however, I've been ambushed by the question of Astaire's right to his dance of praise, and I'll have to skimp a bit the material on James to give my claims about Astaire a fuller chance for a fair hearing. I'll specify this issue when we come to screen the Astaire routines towards the second half of my remarks. As one more remark of orientation before sketching the moments that I announce in James and Astaire, I want at least to mention two of the theoretical sources that I've been most encouraged by in this territory, which I do not here go into, but whose presence, I believe, or hope, may be felt throughout what follows. I mean Heidegger's presentation of the role of thanking or gratitude in his articulation of human thinking, in his text called What is Called Thinking, and in Melanie Klein's emphasis on the radical necessity in human flourishing of the capacity for gratitude, a point at which her work relates most closely to that of Lacan. Turning to the James story, I locate it as the latest in the line of texts that I've been looking at, whose concern with Shakespeare bears on the problem, strangely recurrent, precisely of Shakespeare's praise. Praise of Shakespeare, or its refusal, taken eventually as reflected in praise within Shakespeare's works, or its avoidance. The texts range from Emerson's Shakespeare chapter in his book Representative Men, through Kenneth Burke's permanent essay on Antony's speech of praise over Caesar's body, which praises by denying that it is a speech of praise. I come to bury Caesar, not praise. Continues through the dozen or so entries about Shakespeare included in the miscellany from Wittgenstein's notebook entries, translated into English under the title Culture and Value, where Wittgenstein says, I can see how people take Shakespeare as supreme art, but I don't like it. Who asked him? But somehow one feels one has to come to terms with this monster and say whether you're going to praise it or deplore it or what you're going to do about it. And this sequence of text reaches a crucial juncture in the late Joel Feynman's articulation of Shakespeare's sonnets as, in effect, 154 studies in the necessity and possibility of praise, a marvelous book. It is specifically in response to Feynman's work, preceded, I believe, by that of William Empson, that I go so far as to claim that it is in Shakespeare's sonnets that one finds the most plausible candidates I know in English for the origin of what is called in English-speaking philosophy the skeptical problem of other minds, understood here as our attempt to find another whose existence answers to our desire for it, an existence that it is ours to preserve, as though finding the means of praise is the standing alternative to cursing that existence. James is the birthplace, is the text I know, that best isolates the compulsion to praise Shakespeare, as if expressing gratitude for the author of the works called Shakespeare's is tantamount to an expression of gratitude for the existence of the world, or what is good in it. James insists on the connection by describing the one whose birthplace and shrine he depicts, and never names, as the supreme author, a being he refers to by personal pronouns that are capitalized. That this is some parody of a banal religiosity, and not, say, a simple allegory, is clear enough from the concreteness with which the shrine is packed with a history of untold editions of the author's collected works. The allegorical, however, extends far enough so that the connection of the inner drama of the caretaker's scruples or torments about praise, since he doesn't know anything, with the outer drama of his being under orders by the owners to satisfy a virtually idolatrous demand for praise, speaks of the banality of an institution of devotion coming to measure the sincerity of devotion by the display of cash, that is, measuring belief by what money can buy, a cliché. But what is the direction of James's parody? Is it that towards the deification of the human, which is the way we're now more apt to take it, or towards that of the anthropomorphism of God, which we are apt to take as moot? In either case, the parody, as James develops it, gets the smile wiped off its face. Before saying how or where, I remind you that the recently fashionable topic of the death of the author also announced the issue of authorship in association with theological discourse. The war horses here are Roland Barthes' Death of the Author from 1968 and Foucault's What is an Author from the following year. James, unlike these thinkers, does not seem so ready to take the death of God in stride, though I think one may understand the excruciating conscientiousness of James's prose to know what Emerson meant when he observed that religious people speaking in his hearing sound as if they're announcing the death of God. That was 40 years before Nietzsche, as I think, was quoting Emerson. To locate the few lines there's time to cite from The Birthplace, I note that although its principal character, the one whose hold on life is at once the most intense and the most threatened, Morris Gedge, is not a writer, but the caretaker of a writer's unnamed name, as though really knowing how to name another would be the highest form of praise, it presents him through features that put his story with James's late tales about the puzzles and ironies of the literary life, for example, the author of Beltraffio, The Lesson of the Master, The Next Time, The Figure in the Carpet. I note one such feature now. In The Birthplace, Morris Gedge is observed by a double that doubles the fact that he is married, namely a young married pair of Americans at home with one another, where Morris Gedge and his wife, like so many of other of James's artists and their wives, are rather at odds. You're free to imagine that the Americans are happy and understanding and clearly attractive to one another because their wealth shields them from having to live with and observe in one another their beliefs and tastes compromised. They neither believe with the crowd in the fundamentalist deification of the supreme author, nor do they partake in the temptation to cynicism and destructiveness which the job of guiding this crowd through the shrine incites in Gedge. Their job is to witness and preserve the virtuosity in Gedge's spiritual trials. They're there to see him perform, thread his way through, to preserve himself. Here's how the principles sound together. From James. I'm interested, he, the young American husband, explained, in what I think the interesting thing, or at all events, the eternally tormenting one, the fact of the abysmally little that in proportion we know. In proportion to what? His companion, that is his wife, asked. Well, to what there must have been, to what in fact there is, to wonder about. He escapes us like a thief at night, carrying off everything, and people pretend to catch him, capitalized, like a flown canary. Skipping a couple of pages, Gedge observes, luckily it doesn't at all affect the work. Gedge's wife intervenes. It's our unfortunate ignorance, you mean, that doesn't? Wonderful Henry James words. Unfortunate or fortunate, I like it so, said the husband. The play's the thing. Let the author alone. That's just what they won't do, says Gedge, continuing, nor let me do. It's all I want to let the author alone. Practically, there is no author. That is for us to deal with. There are all the immortal people in the work, but there's nobody else. Yes, said the young man, that's what it comes to. There should really be, to clear the matter up, no such person. As you say, Gedge returned, it is what it comes to. There is no such person. The evening air listened in the warm, thick Midland stillness while the wife's little cry rang out. But wasn't there? There was somebody, said Gedge. But they've killed him. And dead as he is, capitalized, they keep it up. They kill him every day. There are at least four distinct positions here that await articulation. All are involved in coming to terms with our relation to the work that art does, and hence, according to the way I read James, with our, as it were, knowledge of the existence of others. If we say that Gedge's wife is in the most primitive position, taking our ignorance of origins to be simply an empirical matter, then we can say that the American husband is in the most civilized, combining interest with torment and liking the fact of our empirical ignorance. He is as far as you can go in the way of spectatordom. When he says the play's the thing, the tone of enjoyment I get from that brings into view the theory that the thing of art is its invitation to and provision of play, an oasis of freedom within human life, and the cost of letting the artist alone is to let him or her indeed escape us like a thief in the night, rather perhaps than visiting us like a thief at night. It is the equivalent in art, or say an allegory, of a view of religion that would take the absconding or disappearance of God to provide a kind of thrill to the practice of observance. It suggests that humankind would rather praise the void than to be void of praise. This teasing of mine of the end of Nietzsche's genealogy of morals, man would rather take the void for its purpose than to be void of purpose, Nietzsche says, is meant to underline and for the moment to break off from the Nietzschean moment with which my citation of the James story ended, they kill him every day. Is it known whether Henry James read Nietzsche? His brother William cites the genealogy of morals in his Varieties of Religious Experience. In particular, read, I'm asking, James, Henry, I mean, the for us inescapable parable of the madman crying in the public square, that is, I take it, one driven mad from still seeking a public divinity. Whither is God? Nietzsche's madman asks. I shall tell you, we have killed him, you and I. And it goes on to make clear that we're going on doing it. I ask about James's knowledge of Nietzsche just to be clear that on my way of thinking, the answer should not affect one's interest in James's text. If he hadn't heard of the madman, the issue remains at least as pressing to understand how James had arrived at a thought that is shared with autograph Nietzsche. I treasure James's achievement or commitment, something that for me goes beyond what I get out of the pages I cited from Barthes and Foucault. To find the implication, the sustaining of world catastrophe in our daily manners, in the way, for example, so to speak, we capitalize persons, sublime our concepts, Wittgenstein says. The issue between Morris Gedge and the American husband is whether, as the American puts it, there really should be no such person, or as Gedge counters, there is no such person. I suppose neither of these men in the James story speaks for James. I mean the James who 4 years later, for a new edition of Shakespeare, wrote an introduction to The Tempest, which concentrates itself wholeheartedly on accounting for, or rather on acknowledging, the circumstance that he cannot leave the author alone. That, quoting James, there are moments when, speaking for myself, the power of the complete rupture for our understanding between the poet and the man to torment us intellectually seems scarcely to be borne. James's torment, I understand, as a sense of the risk that false thanks kills what it is we have to be grateful for. A traditional concept of this false thanks is idolatry, turning allegiance into superstition. The moment in a stare takes up a different aspect of praise, not so much whether it is sufficient or accurate, as whether it is earned or acceptable, risking not so much idolatry as blasphemy. This praise is not so much false as vain. Because a stare can seem to be subject to this claim of blasphemy, put theologically, there are other ways of putting the claim, I'll mention some, and most explicitly in the second of the routines we are about to consider. And since I claim that his routine is about the possibility of its vanity, I must pause before entering his work to say what I expect from the kind of criticism that I practice, which I would be glad to characterize in the terms in which James calls for a criticism of the future, as he puts it, a criticism that gets into the right relation to an object, James says, by finding the idea to which one may pay tribute, as though praise is essential to what criticism can be. A certain kind of praise, a certain kind of criticism. This seems to me to express what I've tried to prepare for over the years in deriving the task of criticism from Kant's portrayal of the universality and necessity of aesthetic judgment, namely as grounded in its demand for agreement with its response to its object, as invoking pleasure without a concept. Criticism, according to me, becomes a work of determining, as it were after the fact, the grounds of pleasure in the working of an object. In this light, criticism becomes a conduct of gratitude or praise, one can say a specification and test of tribute, one in which I am inherently exposed to rebuke. As Kant roughly puts the matter, the ground of my universal voice in aesthetic judgment, where I demand agreement, remains no other than subjective. It can be rebuked. Matters are otherwise in moral judgment, according to Kant, where the universal voice achieved in the moral law imposes demands upon each of us that are categorical, unrebukable. It is not everyone's idea of criticism, and some may understandably shrink from what may seem an attempt to exact praise. It's here that I most wish I could give an account of a project that I have underway, one consequence of which is to show that Kant's aesthetic judgment is understandable as what I call passionate utterance, a mode of confronting another, the theory of which I derive or continue from what I find to be an unfinished or avoided juncture in J.L. Austin's permanently interesting theory of the performative utterance. I'll say this much here, however, for what it's worth formulaically. Both performative and passionate utterances are modes of address in which our relation to another is put at stake. In the case of Austin's performatives, the stake is defined by invoking a convention, for example, marriage or betting or christening, shared with another a priori, or anyway before this hand. In the case of what I call passionate utterance, it's rather an appeal to the other's freedom. In both cases, our future together is differently staked. And now going on to enter my demand that you agree with the pleasure I take in two routines of Fred Astaire, and to hear out how I ground the pleasure in these objects, I do not expect that our future could not sustain your rebuke of this demand. But of course, there's no knowing in advance. So let me set the scene for the first routine. The character played by Astaire, a song and dance man whose star has faded in Hollywood and who is returning nervously to New York to try a comeback on Broadway, exits from the train that has returned him, takes the awaiting reporters and photographers who have come to interview him, and is rudely awakened to reality as a still vivid star steps out of the adjacent railway car and the news hounds flock to her. It's Ava Gardner in a cameo appearance. As our hero walks away ruefully, being affected by Henry James's prose there, a porter offers a remark to him on the rigors of publicity to which stardom subjects a person, and upon answering, Astaire arrives at his song entitled By Myself. First sequence will last a minute and a half.
I come my way by myself.
Now that's a pity. I wonder if we should try to, the problem with it apparently worked better, I didn't see it, with it, another tape. This has only the sequences on it, but it's a copy, and the machine doesn't like it. Should we try to key it up? Let's, what could you see in that? Not much. Would you fast forward? That one's okay. We don't have time to fool too much around, but if you could cue the other one. Don't. No, no. No, what I'm suggesting is take out this. Oh, I see. Well, let's put up with it. Disappointing. And it'll be terribly disappointing. That, well, all right, so go see it. Let's begin. I mean, you see what's happening. We're playing an American format on this machine, and it's just rebuking us. Uncontroversially, I say, a man walks along a train platform singing. Throughout the singing and walking, the camera has led the man in one continuous shot. When he stops, it stops, and then, as it were, watches him leave through the gate. We then cut to a view from within the station and see the man continue his walk toward us, humming the same tune, then pause and shift nervously, looking around as if expecting someone. If this were theater, the routine would clearly end with the exit out of the gate. Being a film, the entrance humming into the station may count as part of the song. Astaire had begun singing with a little self-conscious laugh, magnified by its producing a palpable cloud of smoke. It's a self-reflective response to the fact that in him, thinking, manifest here classically as melancholy, is about to become singing. Happens in opera, too. I report that when I recall Astaire's delivery of By Myself, it brings with it a sense of emotional hovering. This is the first of three features I note about this routine, or what I call questions raised by it and its representation on film. I attribute in retrospect the sense of his hovering, as if before the prospect of his life, to the fact that his song never reaches to dance, as a song and dance man's song normally must. It is also related to formal features of the music, of which I pick just one here. Its opening chord progression analyzes as a certain form of cadential preparation that can be shown also to fit precisely, perhaps the most famously controversial opening in the history of monstrously familiar music, namely the opening harmonic progression of Tristan and Isolde. If the sound of music can ever sensibly be said to represent suspended animation, I suppose Tristan is the crucial case. But hovering, as if off the earth, is tied also to a formal cinematic feature of the presentation, namely that throughout the walk along the platform, through our watching the exit out of the gate, the camera frames the action so that Astaire's feet are never visible. Not even when he snuffs out the cigarette with his foot, so we read his motion. What formal automatism could more clearly register that this man with those feet never arrives at unequivocal dancing in this routine than that he has no feet? I hedge here, speaking of unequivocal dancing, because the walk of this man is like the walk of no other man on earth, a fact he rather calls attention to with his signature swagger and sway. It's the walk of a man who can at any moment break into dance, as we have known him to do in other films, from the action of driving golf balls or on roller skates or while swabbing the deck of a ship. So what is the relation of dancing to walking? What constitutes either? The framing of the single shot of walking edges somewhere between the thigh and the knee, making something out of a familiar Hollywood proportion. A third feature follows on from the question of visibility. Astaire's feet first appear to us as we cut to him walking into the station, where also we hear him repeating or continuing the tune he has just sung to himself, not precisely by humming it, but with the kind of syllabification or proto-speech that musicians sometimes use to remind themselves of the exact materialization of a passage of sound, but which can occur, as here, as an unguarded expression of a state of consciousness in its distraction, its disorientation, its dispossession. Da, 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 da. He says, or something. That particular consciousness has just been revealed to us by its delivery along the platform in concreteness and richness expressed by whatever is expressed in the song that is still evidently on this fictional figure's mind. Our perception of those proto-speech syllables, da, 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 we must bear in mind, is what is essentially all that the world has so far witnessed of that consciousness. We are alerted to the fact, or the convention, according to which the open delivery of the singing was inaudible, and the opening proto-dancing was unnotable, invisible, within its fictional world. People are shown, at the point of showing so many people walking past him, not seeing what he's doing, without necessarily avoiding this man who seems to be going mad, but we read it differently. In its unnotable appearance, its missability, Astaire's musical syllabification, this kind of proto-speech, very signs of insignificance, together with the routine that it is its condition, emblematizes another way, so it seems to me, of manifesting something Austin and Wittgenstein mean by the ordinary. What's missed in perception? It's here, before setting the scene for the second sequence, that I must... I must explain what I mean by being ambushed by a feature of the question of praise. It concerns what I called vain praise, or the blasphemous, as distinguished from false praise, or the idolatrous. It threatens to swamp the issue that I'm committed to talking about, namely that of finding the means of expressing praise, of acknowledging a dependence upon another, expressing a gratitude for another's existence that shows it to have made one's own independent identity, say one's autonomy, possible. The place I previously developed this theme in most detail is in tracking Othello's skepticism towards Desdemona's faithfulness as a cover story for his inability to sustain his coherence or autonomy in the face of her independent and uninterrupted desire for him. The ambush occurred in discovering that Astaire's second sequence is taken in evidence in a book published to a certain acclaim and influence last year, Michael Rogan's Blackface and White Noise, whose principal burden is the establishment of America's national identity and culture through the appropriation of black culture, constituting, in Rogan's word, racialized entertainment as commodity, a process in which the achievement of the American melting pot for including and amalgamating newcomers to its shores has from beginning to end been achieved at the price of excluding African Americans from the mix. This perception of exclusion must not be denied nor blunted, but Rogan's violence of attitude, understandable as it may be, I mean, a perception of systematic, blatant, and prolonged injustice may brush you with madness or monomania, does not allow him, nevertheless, to recognize that Astaire's dance of praise is itself to be understood specifically as about this painful and potentially deadly irony of the white praise of a black culture whose very terms of praise it has appropriated. I prepare you for the second sequence by quoting Rogan's description of that sequence in full. It's a short paragraph. In Bandwagon, quoting Rogan, an aging Astaire returns to his song and dance roots, so the film opens with an homage to black tap. What it shows, however, is acknowledgement as domination, Forestier dances on a platform above the African-American shoeshine boy, an old man who flips his rag, dances, and blacks up Astaire's shoes. That's the complete treatment of the routine in Rogan's book. Now, incomparably more important than noting at once the mistakes or omissions in this thumbnail account, which might not nevertheless be basically true, is understanding what the conditions are that allow an ambitious thinker like Rogan to propose so casual a description of a work of considerable human imagination. The case is not, I think, one merely in which a writer presumes in advance to know what a work must be expressing, since it is of a piece with a class of works already named and understood and analyzed by him or her. But beyond this presumption, the casualness is a function of a fixed picture of the history of movies as a linear causal sequence of famous events in what Rogan calls mass entertainment, which leaves no room and indeed makes no sense of film as marking the appearance, demonstrated in particular works throughout the years of its existence, of the newest of the great arts. Works, I mean, that bear up under critical pressure and questioning of the kind that definitively marks the work of arts, the arts of theater and painting and poetry, works such as those of Shakespeare and James. Such critical pressure is what I mean to continue bringing to bear as I turn to the second of the Astaire routines. We left Astaire. I wonder if we have time, instead of 6 minutes, to take 12 minutes and redo the first. It's up to you. On a better tape, you think it's essentially a better tape if we start? It's not essentially better. Okay, never mind. We'll bear with it. We left Astaire nervously syllabifying his song, Da Da Dying. Two friends greet him, and in the course of his then walking with them down 42nd Street in New York, where he had been a star, his friends excitedly chattering about a great new script for his comeback and for a new kind of theater, Astaire becomes disoriented. He asks what's happened to the theaters on Broadway, points to one or two absences of places that he had played 20 years younger, earlier, and contrives to extricate himself for a while from their company. A flaneur has he not, to be alone within the world. All alone in a crowd, he says, sounding like Benjamin. He crosses a wide, crowded sidewalk. I mean, all alone in a crowd was from the tune we just, at most, heard. He crosses a wide, crowded sidewalk towards an amusement arcade, and at its entrance asks a man behind a counter, "Say, didn't this used to be the Elgin Theater?" The man's answer is to put a hot dog in Astaire's hand. The routine has begun. So bear with this, and I will, in my descriptions of it, note a number of the events, so we'll see how well it can jog.
Theater.
Well, now I'm in the position of demanding that you take pleasure in that. This was supposed to be a present. instead of something that a contemporary filmmaker might have done as a parody of this this film. What are these words that I'm about to say? I mean, the opening words are, one unfolds as a masterpiece of dance. Well, you just have to believe that. You don't have to believe that I think so. Or of something inseparable from serious dance. What is it? It's as complex and eventful as the former routine on the train platform was simple and uneventful. In it, the issues raised by the first routine are settled or unsettled. They're taken to a new place. Not only have Astaire's feet become visible, but they seem to be the leading characters of the routine. And not only does he not continue to hover, but at a certain point leaps to earth with extraordinary consequences. Just how and where has this man managed this metamorphosis or quasi-metempsychosis? Not finding a new body, but finding it anew. To get into some control of the complexity of these events, let's divide the routine into three main sections and an epilogue. The central section is the duet with the black shoeshine man. In the section preceding the duet, the first section, Astaire, as it were, finds his way to that man. In the section succeeding the duet, Astaire moves into a solo. In the epilogue, the two men re-encounter one another and formally part. First section. It's a set of adventures with various machines of amusement and chance. Astaire hands the hot dog to a young boy as if to separate himself from childish things, even from things associated with the wrong kind of entertainment, for example, food concessions in the lobby of movie theaters, or for all I know, of minstrel shows. He passes an exhibit, a cage topped with a sign, wouldn't have seen it, Ape and Bride, housing two such life-sized mechanical figures, looking like an animated version of an old movie poster or a movie preoccupation, evidently a monument to the former existence of this location as a movie house. He goes on to encounter a closed machine with a large question mark decorating it, as if containing the answer to an unknown question or quest. He takes a fortune from a mechanical gypsy woman, Madame Olga, in an enclosure which resembles a ticket booth, from which he receives one ticket of fortune, which he does not like and tosses aside, and then receives another which he finds more encouraging, but also nonchalantly tosses aside. He plays a sort of pinball poker game, which he wins by cheating. He asks a neighboring machine for a measure of his love appeal and is declared gorgeous. He sees himself in a distorting mirror and checks back with that former declaration. So far, he's been amused by augury. But then something serious happens. He trips over the outstretched legs of a meditative shoeshine man. which inspires him to stop and think, that is, to begin singing to him. His various encounters with machines have each been ready to tell him who he is, which suggests that the ensuing routine is a dance of identity, from mechanical fortunes to mechanical labels to mirror images, making everyone look more alike, more or less alike in their distortion. Supplementary reminders that he has been displaced by the mechanism of film and will perhaps find his fortune in being redeemed by it. The place that he's entered, replacing the place that had replaced the Broadway theater he had in another life entered and in which he had found his identity as a star, turns out to be an allegorical version, perhaps no more of a movie theater than of a sound stage, as if he's searching out new origins or searching for them in a new way, in an unpredicted place, yet still one of entertainment or show. What does the mechanically reproductive art of film show? Second section. The song he sings to the shoeshine man begins by declaring itself as the antidote to the melancholy he had expressed in By Myself. When you feel as low as the bottom of a well and can't get out of the mood, do something to perk yourself up and change your attitude. At the beginning of this verse, the black man is unimpressed by Astaire's song or his singing, but at the end of the verse, when the idea of getting a shine on your shoes is introduced as the something in question to do, and Astaire makes some initial moves with his feet, beating a step with them against the answering shoeshine stand, the shoeshine man's consciousness is attracted. He, in effect, invites Astaire onto the stand and provides the song with a habitation and a new beat with his brushes, a cross between wire snare drum brushes and a wood block. Now, the song proper, A Shine on Your Shoes, contains an impropriety so absolute as to threaten to undermine from the outset the celebratory air we've been preparing for. The noun shine, I don't know how well known this is any longer, has been a derogatory name for a black man. The audience for this song has now, that's us, has a choice. You can either understand Astaire and the establishment of talent implicated in the production of such a work to be using the word conformably, accepting its derogatory association, or you can understand Astaire to be mentioning this word as part of risking the full sense of what it means for him to be singing this song to this man. It is essential that the shoeshine man be black, specifically African American, for the routine to be the one that I have begun reading. Call it Astaire's comeback song. In the fantastic shoeshine which ensues, Astaire planted in air, his feet rhythmically shifted on golden pedestals, Astaire's shoes are not simply brushed and waxed and polished, as if to declare that what, but something else, as if to declare that what the black man is doing with his wands and cloth is not labor alone, as if its object is not to transform shoes, but to transfigure the creature who wears shoes. This is further signaled when the operation on the stand requires waving the cloth to no practical end over Astaire's hands as well as his feet. In a second chorus of the song, the shoeshine man moves in a kind of enhanced shuffle completely around the stand. That is to say, he completely traces a circle around Astaire, who turns with him, studying his every move, anything but dominating him, in that moment anyway, as Rogan suggests. At the completion of the circle and of the song, Astaire leaps over the head of the black man out of the magic circle and arrives at his ground. Section 3. Finding himself now released to his element, Astaire begins a solo which is no more a dance than it is an ecstatic weaving of frenzy, less a finished work than an effort to reach to the origins of what requires the lunging and reeling of dance, accompanied by his incessant repetition, possessed as if a shaman, as having become transfigured into a dervish of the words, shoeshine, shine on my shoes, I've got a shoeshine. Repeating those words more than 70 times when I stopped counting. Taking in, trying to make out what happened to him, how it happens that he's found his feet again, come into his body again, asking what his words mean when he cannot just not know what they mean. It's the moment or condition of comeback that the discovery of intact existence expresses itself here as ecstasy. It's linked in my mind with Thoreau's once expressing his recognition of his double existence, say a seer and a seen, as a condition of being beside himself, by himself, roughly the dictionary definition of ecstasy. He holds his hands to his head as if he has brushed against insanity, something in the search for his origins has the power of derangement. Whereas in the first section, or the pre-dance, or proto-dance, he was seeking news of his fortune from an array of physical or mechanical sources, now his unpredictable career through the hall of fortune sets things off. A gun fires off, tin bottles leap apart with only the threat of a thrown baseball, a comically withdrawn and awkwardly tall woman screams in terror at what this man exudes as he moves towards her. He astonishingly sets his working body into an automatic photograph booth and manages to have it take a portrait of his foot, or strictly speaking, as the epistemologists used to say, of the shine on his shoes. Reapproaches the mysterious machine that flaunts its mysterious chancy question mark, and this time transforms it into a phantasmagoria of whistles, flags, flashing lights, to the blare of a Sousa march, a monument of banal Hollywood, American ballyhoo, upon which he turns from the celebrating spectators, away from those who celebrate only this kind of ballyhoo way, and in two or three revolutions of his body, re-encounters the shoeshine man. Epilogue. The sound of big band sophistication, an Apollo Theater finale, at once intervenes, and the two men, for the first time dancing on the level together, enter into a perfectly recognizable and perfectly executed walk-off, quite as if the whole routine had been a matter of their somehow dancing together. Since I wish to claim that in this dance of identity, Astaire provides himself with an occasion for acknowledging his indebtedness for his existence as a dancer, his deepest identity, to the genius of black dancing, and since I accordingly must face the knowledge that this acknowledgement or homage or the right to it on the part of Astaire is to be contested, since this very man, taken differently, represents a perfect American appropriation of a discovery of black creativity, I ask, may the details of this remarkable routine be taken into account in thinking through this fateful ambiguity? Here's a suggestion about how it might be taken up. We've so far seen the responses in the second routine to two of the issues I noted in the first routine on the train platform. Hovering has found its landing, melancholy has found its ecstasy. This last issue I raised concerns the visibility of what we're privileged to see. I mean, in the first place, its visibility to the world within which it's depicted as taking place. I took it as fairly obvious that Astaire's song and walk are inaudible and invisible to that world. That's not obvious in the case of a routine in the arcade, but alerted to the question, I find the question raised there. What do we imagine the passers-by see as couples or individuals multiply and move past the duet taking place on and around the shoeshine stand, as they glance, sometimes smile, point at something happening out of the ordinary, and yet not something any feel invited to form an audience for? Various among them are singled out by the raving of the solo, but after the photographic session with his foot, he seems to have lost his public, until he does that dance riff against the mystery machine, and it goes off. I've said that he moves away from the crowd attracted by the ballyhoo and refinds the shoeshine man. As the two of them go into their routine of departure, there's a notable set of onlookers at the exit into which Astaire vanishes as the two and passers-by on the pavement outside, a crowd into which Astaire vanishes as they conclude their accomplished farewells. It's a moment of unexpected poignancy. Is it entirely derived from the recognition that after what these two have accomplished together, the black man is left on his knees, having returned the hat and whisked the white man's suit and accepted a handshake and a tip from him as he leaves to cash in on his comeback? I think matters are in a sense better and in a sense worse than this. Better because while all that the crowd sees at the end is a familiar vaudeville exit, isolated from the conditions that have made it possible, they are merely ignorant of something, of what has led up to this moment and speaks to its significance. But matters are in a sense worse because we privileged ones have had the visible formed for us. It's up to us to recognize that this routine is as much about the appropriation of another's dancing as it is about the origin of dancing in ecstasy. Then it's up to each of us to determine whether we can accept pleasure on this basis from this manifestation. In declaring my acceptance of it, I go back to the men's re-encounter of one another for their walk-off. I recall that as they reach the entrance of the arcade, the marquee from a neighboring theater is visible above their heads, announcing, "This proud land," a gag. I wouldn't think it rational to suppose that someone among the talented producers of Band, or I'm just assuming that that's intended by the makers. Beyond the ungovernable irony, I take the placement above the center of the entrance, exit, both, to suggest that the arcade itself is a portrait or allegory of the proud land, call it America, containing not only amusements and occupations and false promises for which those with nothing better to do, for those with nothing better, but a territory of magic or exemption in which such things as that walk-off can form itself. I've said it's perfect in recognition and execution. I mean that it demonstrates that these two can dance together for a while on an equal basis, equally choreographed, equally standing, equally kneeling, equally happy with the knowledge of their achievement in their joint work, a momentary achievement of the kingdom of ends, but demonstrates at the same time that they cannot leave the scene of entertainment together and cannot, for no good reason. Nobody does what Astaire does better than Astaire does it. It is in its transcendent accomplishment that it claims the standing to pay homage to the transcendent accomplishment of black dancing. It hurts that his work changes nothing in the conditions of injustice under which the debt has been incurred. But what hurts unnecessarily, what contributes to a frenzy of hurt, a dance of frenzy, is the denial of the claim Astaire's expression has achieved, the claim that the conditions of the dance are part of the dance, that the pain of this leave-taking haunts the pleasure of its accomplishment, that not to recognize the pain is to deny that it is a call for change, that the homage has itself constituted a step of change in a world with such a problem in it. Then Astaire's praise is unseen and unheard by us. Our praise of him is to that extent false and vain. What is it to have a culture? I think I should end there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Coble. I know that I will also be, I know that I, at least, I think many others of us will also be looking for a videotape to hire to have a look at those sequences of Bandwagon. But I also very much appreciate the end point, that very last question that you left us with this evening. And I hope that in the rest of the evening, after the interval of 30 minutes, we will also see other ways of posing that question, as we do in the archival material on display. Thank you very much indeed for a stimulating lecture, for one which demonstrates some of the difficulties of the technological rather than linguistic divide of the Atlantic. I can thank you again for coming today from the United States for this lecture, and I hope that you will join us with a refreshments and mingle with the crowd. And at the end of the interval, which will last for 30 minutes, 25 minutes, we'll resume again at 25 past. We'll come back for the second half of the evening. In the interval, there is a cash bar in the corner. You're also invited to look at the exhibits, to try the catalogue, to see what we've got so far. Thank you.
Thank you again.